I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond, by even a millimeter, what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable, nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
When I was dealing, Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with a cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he survives. If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we have, we register, the incidence about 14.7 per 1,000 live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per 1,000. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable, too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the U.S. Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap? When it gets there, when they bring it there, then they put it in the ground, what do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
A new poll suggests Americans are growing increasingly pessimistic about the state of democracy, with a majority believing that an election will be overturned in the next few years because elected officials are dissatisfied with the result. The survey conducted by CNN and SSRS found that 56% of respondents believe American democracy is under attack. 37% of those polled said American democracy is being tested but is not under attack, and 6% said American democracy is in no danger. Those numbers, however, begin to split when looking at the party breakdowns. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mikhail Chanel Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Poll Says Majority of Americans Say Democracy Is Under Attack. Stay tuned for more. A new poll suggests Americans are growing increasingly pessimistic about the state of democracy, with a majority believing that the election will be overturned in the next few years because elected officials are dissatisfied with the result. The survey conducted by CNN and SSRS found that 56% of respondents believe American democracy is under attack. 37% of those polled said American democracy is being tested but is not under attack, and 6% said American democracy is in no danger. Those numbers, however, began to split when looking at the party breakdowns. The poll found that 75% of Republicans believe that democracy is under attack compared to 46% of Democrats. When observing Republicans and Republican-leaning independents, individuals who say former President Donald Trump is the leader of the GOP are far likelier to say democracy is under threat compared to those who do not believe he should lead the party, 79% to 51%, respectively. Americans, however, were virtually split when it came to confidence in U.S. elections reflecting the will of the people. 48% of respondents said they were very or somewhat confident in American elections, compared to 52% who said they were just a little or not at all confident. With a margin of error of 2.8 percentage points, those levels are deadlocked. The poll also found that 51% of respondents say it is very likely to somewhat likely that in the next few years, some elected officials will successfully overturn the results of a U.S. election because their party did not win. 49% of respondents said such a situation is not too likely or not likely at all. The polling comes after Trump and his allies waged a campaign that argued that the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent, despite there being scant evidence to bolster those claims. A number of GOP-led states have since introduced legislation to combat the alleged fraud. According to the Brennan Center, as of July, 18 states have already enacted 30 laws that will make it more difficult for Americans to vote. The poll surveyed 2,119 people between August 3rd and September 7th. Senate Democrats recently unveiled an election reform bill that would expand things like mail-in and early voting and crack down on election subversion and money in politics, their effort to counteract GOP state voting restrictions. However, though the bill has the backing of moderate Senator Joe Manchin, it lacks support from Senate Republicans and is unlikely to overcome the Senate's 60-vote filibuster threshold. Recent moves by Trump and his allies are likely to only worsen Republican voters' faith in elections. Trump and California recall candidate Larry Elder, a right-wing radio host, repeatedly and baselessly claimed in the run-up to the vote that it would be stolen through widespread fraud. California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, handily beat back the recall effort recently.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Things don't seem to be so rosy with U.S. allies these days. First, many felt ignored when Washington decided to swiftly withdraw from Afghanistan without consulting its allies, and now it's AUKUS. A security pact between the U.S., U.K., and Australia has sidelined France and caused Canberra to withdraw from a $40 billion submarine deal with Paris. The French are livid, and the U.K. and the U.S. say it's nothing important. Now, the pact is also a cause of concern for China and possible escalation of nukes. Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to start this off crossing over to Brussels, talking to our correspondent, Jerome Hughes. Wow, lots of friction here. Go for it. Tell me what's going on and the reaction from the European Union.
That's right, Marzia. No doubt that there are tensions now. We know that Canberra ditched the plans, the contract, the submarine contract with France in favor of the United States and Britain, a contract with them, and this has caused tensions. And in response, what Paris has done is recalled its ambassadors to the United States and Australia. Strangely, the UK doesn't seem to be as much in the firing line, but I think that's because the main players in this for France would be the United States and Britain. And, you know, we see divisions within the European Union, we just see divisions within NATO. And don't forget, the UK, Britain and France are all members of the G7 group of countries. So now we're seeing divisions in the G7. So it's not clear exactly how this will pan out, but no doubt that Emmanuel Macron will have one eye on the forthcoming elections in France. So we're heading into an election year, and this is a big deal for him. It makes him look bad, and he certainly won't be wanting any sort of kickback in the polls and also for when he's fighting for re-election. So we have to see how it goes. You know, the other thing that we're hearing is that we have to look deeper into this. I mean, what influence perhaps does the arms industry have in all of this? We know that it's exceptionally powerful as a lobby group in the United States. So what maybe is going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, that's a big question. And also we might hear from the likes of Macron and Merkel and other people asking the European Commission to tone down this constant rhetoric we're hearing on a daily basis of the EU needing to become more autonomous, less reliant on the United States, and all of this pushing towards an EU army. So I think the likes of Macron might be saying to those people in the European Commission, calm this down a little bit, because you know, we're seeing a bit of a backlash from the United States.
All right, very interesting. Thanks so much for that update, Jerome Hughes. I'd like to welcome my guest now to this program, Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones out of Leesburg. And writer and political commentator, John White of Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with William, your perspective. Why has this trilateral pact been made at this time, in your perspective?
Well, this is very dramatic, and this is very worrying. I think we have escalated a little bit up towards military conflict unless we can pull back somewhat. This is a very dramatic move because the sharing of these technologies, nuclear propulsion technologies, were the purview in many respects of the United States, but also in 1958 they brought the Brits in with them, and this Anglo-American special relationship has been in all the wars since the end of World War II, and is very close and relates to a rather imperial outlook stemming probably from the British Empire. That's been adopted by the Americans in many respects. But bringing the Aussies in here, of course, it was twofold. One thing, of course, the Australians who have been in a fight with China and don't seem to want to compromise in any way, want to have a better position here, and so that they've been lobbying for this, with the Brits in particular, for this nuclear deal. But also Biden, who wants a stronger force really surrounding China and monitoring China, also thought that by upgrading this agreement, bringing in the Aussies in this thing is going to be a way of increasing the pressure on China, which of course it will do. But of course he's made a lot of enemies in the meantime, and it's really when the dust settles, it really is going to be hard to figure out who is really still a friend and who is much more suspicious of this Anglo-American conspiracy, not least of all in Asia, not only the Chinese, of course, but also all the other Asian countries who see this Anglo element in the new policy. Mm. They will not be happy with this at all.
Okay, well, John, your take, why do you think this was done in the way that it was? I mean, what was the overall goal? Or were they not even thinking about the overall effect that it would have, for example, on the French or the Europeans in general?
Well, I think, Amina, this is a very significant démarche development and has serious ramifications for the Western alliance, for NATO in particular. I think it's an act of desperation. I think it comes in the wake of the Afghanistan debacle. And I think it shows that the Biden administration is perhaps even more incompetent and reckless than the Trump administration, which preceded it, if that can be so said. I do believe that just weeks after retreating from Afghanistan with their tail between their legs, it is not the most propitious time to be forming a bloc or a military bloc with the clear objective of taking on China. It has ramifications for the international order. Australia signed up to the precepts of the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1973, and if Australia is going to acquire nuclear submarines, that's a clear violation of its obligations under its membership of the NPT. Here you have Iran being demonized, being castigated, being sanctioned, because it is a member of the NPT but chooses to develop nuclear energy for domestic purposes slowly. Israel has some 90 nuclear warheads and the fissile material to develop another 200. It's not a member of the NPT. So this throws up all the contradictions of the international order, the way the West and certainly major powers such as the US is able to flout international law and to flout its obligations under treaties that it has so signed. So this is a panicked response to the growing soft power, more than hard power, influence of China in the world, and it is an attempt to go back in time to a period where the US enjoyed complete hegemony in the wake of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. It is panicked, it's desperate, and it just shows you that the West is in decline and it has no answers to the challenges of today or the future, which China clearly does have under its stunning success of its Belt and Road Initiative.
Well, William, your take. I mean, why do you think that Canberra has basically made a deal with Paris null and void, and they did it in the way that they did it? I mean, wasn't there, perhaps a better way, or having consulted France ahead of time? If France said that it had been working on this, I guess, 4 years, and basically the deal was inked, and nothing. So what does it mean overall as far as reliability in dealing with these countries?
Well, obviously, there's a great deal of mistrust now between the various nations, not only the French and Australian split, but also the U.S. and French split, which I think is going to be much more long-lasting than one can assume. I mean, they called off a celebration they were having on Franco-American friendship, pulled back the ambassadors, and when they'll be coming back, we just don't know. So that there is a serious split within NATO because of this. And the fact that the Australians were keeping this very secret, I think, is they certainly wanted to have it as a deal before they broke the other deal, I think. But I think nobody really wanted to talk about it or to indicate that this was in the works until it was a done deal, because they realized how dramatic this would be. And had there been an outcry prior to the deal being settled, it might not have happened at all. But it's a very serious development, and I'm sure the Chinese and the Russians are now looking very closely at countermeasures they might want to take with this escalation, which is now you'll have, you know, these nuclear submarines surrounding the coast of China, you know, interminably. That's not a situation that they're very happy with, and I'm sure, although they're approaching it from the nuclear proliferation angle, as the other speaker mentioned, it is a breach of the NPT. Australia is not a member of the NPT, and while this doesn't give them a nuclear weapon, it gives them a really tremendous nuclear capability, which probably would have to be a part of the NPT. So all of this is still up in the air. And I think it's going to be a while before the dust settles on this thing, but it has serious consequences for peace, for cooperation, and for dealing with a lot of the major issues that are facing the world today.
Mm. John, your take on that. I mean, what do you think is the overall goal? Because as William has just said, it's going to increase tension in the region, especially surrounding China with nuclear submarines. I mean, do the Aussies want to take on China? Does the United States really want to take on China in a military conflict? Or what's the overall goal?
Well, I don't know where William gets his information from, but my information is that Australia signed up to the NPT in 1973. But besides that point, it's Washington's imperial hegemonic decline continues at a pace. And this is a desperate attempt to shore up its fading hegemony, as I said earlier. I think the Chinese will look at this with the contempt it deserves. China already has the largest navy in the world. China is a massive economy, the only economy that grew in the midst of COVID in 2020, while the US returned a negative growth rate of 3.15%. The UK has been very opportunistic in this, because in this Brexit, post-Brexit age, is looking to hire itself out as a gun for hire, so to speak. China's strength, as I said, is its soft power under this Belt and Road Initiative, where China comes with investment, the US and the West in general comes with bombs and missiles and saber-rattling and military aggression. That day has passed. The West has no answer to the challenges of the 20th century. China does have. It understands interdependence, not nationalism, not nativism, is the answer to the challenges of the world, whether it's in terms of the economy, in terms of the climate emergency, in terms of the issues surrounding the global emergency of refugee crises produced by wars and induced by the instability wrought by Western foreign policy. So China is the future. China and those aligned with China are the future. And the West, this is a desperate attempt to shore up Western hegemony. France will now have to look at its own strategic vision anew. It will have to decide whether its interests are in keeping with continuing with a US-aligned leadership, or whether it should look at its relations with Russia, China, and the East in general in a different light. Because let's be clear, this is not just in terms of a material demarche from the old order. France is America's oldest ally. It stems back to the Revolutionary War of the late 18th century. This is a slap in the face for France, and this is very significant and a very serious fork in the road when it comes to France. France will have to, as I say, look at its strategic relations with the US and with the West in general in a different light as a result of this clear insult and breach of integrity and of partnership which it thought it had forged with Western powers, US and Australia in particular.
Well, William, since the start of the COVID pandemic, we've seen lots of strong-arm tactics by the U.S. towards its allies, whether it was stealing masks from allies or trying to hijack ventilators. I mean, it just seems that the hegemon of the time is imploding. And do you think that France should actually be surprised? I mean, John just said that France is the oldest ally of the United States. But in evaluating the actions of the United States, especially lately, should any country be surprised?
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised. Maybe they shouldn't be surprised. Everybody knew about the special relationship with Britain, and now it's become an overall English-speaking community. I think the implications are very important. I think that the upside here is that the distrust that has been increased as a result of this can lead to some interesting developments. Of course, the Europeans are now talking even more about having their own defense capability and the like, which is all well and good. But I think also there's another aspect to it, and that is that most of the Europeans were not very happy about the kind of militant attitudes taken by the Biden administration with the continuation, its own version of the pivot, the Quad, and all these other operations to really contain China, because they feel that China is very beneficial to them. As your other speaker mentioned, China has the Belt and Road Initiative, which has been very profitable and very prosperous for European nations. And they don't want to give that up. And they've been kowtowing to the United States for a long time to keep this so-called Western unity. But now that it's become simply a English-speaking grouping, they might not be so interested in sticking with the United States, and they may, in fact, do deals with China that they were prohibited from doing because of the school marm. The United States was looking over their shoulder. Now I don't think they're going to spend so much time on that.
How likely do you think that's going to happen, William? How likely do you see a realignment that could possibly happen with France more looking towards the East, towards looking at China or Russia?
I think there's a good possibility here. Look what we had, and depending on the situation in Germany, of course, they were very interested in the BRI, and now you have a new leadership there, and we'll have to see how that pans out. But both in terms of the relationship with Russia and the relationship with China, most of the European nations were less inclined to take a hard line against these countries. They have their problems with China, and they will talk about them. But I don't think they want to make it into a conflict, and I don't think that they want to break relations with China or create a situation that's damaging to their own economy. And that this new development now really kind of gives them a pretext for not following the rules that are being set by the United States, because it's now this English language hegemon whom they really don't like so much. So it could have an interesting turn, but initially they'll also talk about defense. They'll talk about being in the Indo-Pacific themselves, but I don't think they want a conflict in the same way or at least don't want to move towards a conflict in the same way that the Biden administration is in fact doing. So I think there will be a fallout from that.
Well, John, your take on and where this may go, because as both of you have talked about, interesting possibilities and perhaps breaking that whole Western-type hegemon on so many different things, because the possibilities are endless, as a matter of fact, if the French and perhaps other Europeans start looking more towards the East. Your take on it all, your overall assessment of where this is likely to go.
Well, the fact that this bloc or alliance was negotiated for 6 months without the knowledge of the French speaks volumes as to the changing world order. As I said in my initial remarks, this has serious ramifications for the future of NATO, in which France has always been a key member. It's an insult to France's integrity, its sense of amor propre, its honor, and I think this is reflected in the quite significant and unprecedented way that Macron has withdrawn his ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. So the French are taking this hugely seriously. This is a real breach in the Western alliance. It comes on the heels of the way the US precipitously withdrew from Kabul, Afghanistan, without really consulting with its Western allies, in this instance the UK and Australia at that time. So it shows that the Biden administration is in many respects following on the same policy of the Trump administration, which is isolationism, which is America first in all but name. So I think this is significant. I think this is a historic tipping point in the decline of the West. And I think the Chinese will gain much succor from this, because they understand that this represents a breach in the Western alliance, and it provides opportunities for it to gain more influence in the West vis-a-vis Europe, and I mean mainland Europe, not the UK. So I'm actually quite encouraged by this development. The West, in terms of the English-speaking peoples, which William rightly cites in his remarks, you know that Boris Johnson is a great champion of the mindset of Winston Churchill, who wrote that famous history, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples, sees that as a future for Brexit Britain. But I think that it is a further signpost on the trajectory of decline of the West in terms of the geopolitical, military, cultural hegemony. So China is clearly winning this battle without firing a shot, and soft power are being met by hard power is representative of the decline of hard power.
All right, and on that note, I thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Executive from Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones out of Leesburg, and writer and